So maybe another way of thinking about it is, are we just reducing harm or are we actually nurturing? Right. And what's the change in the business model, the business vision, the very way we think about what we're doing, our purpose, our legacy? What's the change in all of that that goes with that shift from reducing harm, which is a good thing? I'm not saying it's not a good thing, but it's not good enough. Mm. We actually need to shift to nurturing, and that presents us with a paradigm shift.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode 29 of the Building Better Leaders podcast. Welcome if you are listening to us for the first time. Thank you for being here. And if you are a regular listener, thank you so much for being on this journey with us. We really do appreciate it. Today's conversation is all about climate change and sustainability as a concept. And really, what we're doing today with our very special guest is talking about what we as a group of leaders and coaches can do in the business context about climate change. So today we are joined by Josie McLean. Josie is a systemic change specialist. She's also a coach and she has a PhD in organizational sustainability. She is one of the three founders of the Climate Coaching Alliance, which is an organization that was founded only a year ago to unite coaches to help leaders think about climate change and sustainability in different ways. I am a brand new member to that organization and I'm really excited about exploring this topic of climate change and how important it is for our future survival in this conversation. Enjoy. So Josie, welcome to the podcast. Do you want to introduce yourself and tell our listeners a little bit about you and what you do?
Okay. Well, it's a delight to be with you, Rachel and John. Thanks for having me along as a guest to talk about this topic that's really close to my heart. So I'm getting a bit long in the tooth, you know. I've been around for a while. And so if I tell you my whole history, we could be here all night just talking about that. But if I can sum it up as quickly as possible, I started my working life as a corporate strategic planner. So I was a financial analyst. And I worked in the auto and finance industries. I had children. And when I decided to come back to work, I found I couldn't get work doing the types of things I used to do because I was too old and too female. Who knew? And anyway, so I set up my own business and coaching was just emerging in Australia. And I started coaching. And I became interested in executive coaching. I've always been future orientated. And then I became involved in setting up the professional industry here in Australia. And in 2003, I found myself in the position of organising the ICF regional conference in Australasia and also being president of the ICF here in Australasia. And I invited Sir John Whitmore out as one of our keynote speakers. And I can remember sitting with John having this gorgeous talk about the work that he was doing. And that conversation changed my world because during that conversation, I realised that we were on a trajectory, we humans, to actually killing ourselves. And it was a fairly alarming realisation. And that conversation has altered the path of my life since. Since 2003, I've been a volunteer activist with the Pachamama Alliance in San Francisco. I've done a PhD examining how organisations can transform themselves from the inside out, just like people do, to actually nurture rather than exploit the people and the planet. And along the way, I've also set up a couple of not-for-profits, and I've been involved with Alison and Eve in setting up the Climate Coaching Alliance. So the sort of work I do is systemic work, and I'm heavily informed by the theory and the reality of living systems, that we are indeed living systems. And we operate in ways that is quite contrary to the way we tend to operate habitually, but not naturally within organisations. So that's a little bit about me and what I do.
Amazing. It's just so much that you've fitted in there. It's really, really inspiring. And I think for people that are new to this concept of kind of coaching and leadership and systems theories, I think one of the easiest ways to explain what you've just talked about then is one of the things that I learned while I was studying it at uni that Michael Kavanagh shared. And for our listeners, while we were just chatting pre-recording this podcast, we've realised we have somebody in common, don't we, the late Tony Grant. He was one of my professors at Sydney University, and you knew him. And what I think is really lovely is that, you know, Eve and Alison, the other founders of the Climate Coaching Alliance, are based in the UK. So it's all, the world's getting smaller, isn't it? And back to this point, I think habitually we tend to think of, you know, business and financial objectives as the most important thing at the center of business. You know, that's the focus. And then we think about the people that kind of work or society around that. And then we think about, oh, there's this thing called the environment, and that's the last kind of circle. And we'll employ a corporate social responsibility person or a sustainability person, and we've ticked that box. And what I really loved about it when I was kind of first introduced to this notion of systems theory is Michael got us to draw three circles. How could we draw them that demonstrated the level of importance of each? And, you know, some people kind of drew three overlapping circles with that meet in the middle. Some people drew them quite separate. And actually he talked about, well, really the most important circle is the environment. And everything sits within the environment. So that needs to be the first focus, because without an environment, none of us survive. And then you've got to think about society being the next biggest circle that sits within the environment. And that talks about the system in which we operate, because if we don't have markets, if we don't have societies that we trust, we are interconnected. There is no labor pool if we don't work as a functioning society. And then the smallest circle, which is totally dependent on the other two, is the world of business. And for me, that one diagram just rocked my world. And I was like, oh, I've been thinking about it the wrong way my entire career.
And we've been taught to, so don't feel bad. Mm. You know, that's the way the MBAs used to be set up. And they too are changing. I know that because I do a little bit of teaching within one. But we were taught that. Like, I can remember when I did my economics degree, there was no consideration of the resources that were available to feed the machinery of business. You know, it just didn't exist. And it's only recently that we've got theories like modern monetary theory and the donut economics and ideas like that are emerging that actually do take that outer circle that Michael was talking about of the environment, and then link in society and say, actually, we need economic policy that's also socially just. This is important, otherwise we can't continue. So it's a dawning realization, I think, and it's been dawning on us since about 1950, if you track it back. Mm. And it's been around a while, so it's about 70 years now, so it's about time we normalized it. And in fact, this is the way we live our lives, isn't it, really? We don't live it. We don't plan our lives the same as we do in organisations. You know, we make decisions that aren't always just focused on getting the absolute maximum dollar value all the time. I know some people think about it a lot, but I was really struck during the 2010 drought here in Australia, the millennium drought, and it finished in 2010. And the Murray River, which is our dominant river here in Australia, we've only sort of got one. Not like England. Well, we do have more than one. That's not strictly true, but it's quite a big and important river. And it was running very dry. And in South Australia, we are totally dependent upon that river for our water. And there were farmers up near the border of South Australia and Victoria who actually chose to withgo some of their water rights in order to give water back to the environment. And I was so impressed by that. Everyone says, oh, no, people don't act in altruistic ways, but they do. You know, we do make decisions based on other criteria. I think perhaps we have learned some lessons that aren't true about ourselves.
Yeah.
I've got, I've listening to you there, Josie, I've got so many questions in my head, but the one that was sort of jumping out at me really is, so you met John Whitmore in 2003, and you were saying that, you know, like it probably changed your life, the conversation that you had, and it's the general awareness of the need for us to deal with climate change and conservation at an individual level, I think is fairly high. And we'll watch programs with David Attenborough narrating them and what was the name of it, Rachel? His
witness statement to the world.
And, you know, really, really quite graphic and quite mind blowing. I'm just wondering where do you think the level is of awareness at a business stage, a business level? Because if every business was able to do something about climate change, then we would move the thing a lot further and a lot quicker than we were trying to do it on an individual basis. And I'm just interested to know what your appreciation of that is, both in Australia and the, you know, the wider world.
So I think my opening response to that would be that it's very hard to tell.
Mm.
And if I went a little bit academic on you for a moment, within the academic literature, there is this idea of weak sustainability and strong sustainability. And remind me to come back and link sustainability and climate change in a moment. Weak sustainability is considered to be those actions we take that are within the existing paradigm of the way we do things. So that might be the corporate social responsibility, or it might be just removing waste from the organisation to the level at which you cease gaining profit gain. Does that make sense? You keep reducing your expenses, but once you get to the level where you can't reduce them anymore, you go, oh, well, I've picked all the low-hanging fruit. What else am I going to do? And you go back to growing your markets and doing everything the way you were doing it before. So that's kind of an idea of what weak sustainability would look like in an organisation. Were you trying to say something, Rachel?
Oh, sorry. I was just saying it's thinking in the same way about the problem. So it's using what you've already got to refocus your energies in a new area. That's weak sustainability.
Yeah.
If I've got that clear, then on a very micro level, I've had a printer here for last 10 years and I keep topping it up with cartridges and what have you. And the other day I went to print and I put some brand new cartridges in and it wasn't working properly and tried to clean it all and all the rest and it's not working. And it's made me start thinking, do I need to really actually have a printer at all? Because on my floor here, I've got loads of paper that all need shredding from loads of reports that I've written years ago. And I'm thinking to myself, I need to rethink that. Now, is that an example of weak sustainability that I cut that cost out?
Let me take your example another step further. So you could reduce the amount of damage you're doing in the world by not using the cartridges, by not using the printer, by not using the electricity, by not using the paper. But how could you turn it around so that you're actually nurturing the world? That would be strong sustainability.
Right, right.
That's a different question.
Now, you can't necessarily do that with the one example of the printer. That on the one hand, you can reduce the cost and the cost of the environment, but you probably have to find something else in your business or something else to add back. And our people at that level, they can cut the cost. But they're not thinking about what they can do to add it back. And then that becomes strong sustainability.
So maybe another way of thinking about it is, are we just reducing harm or are we actually nurturing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, are we nurturing?
And what's the change in the business model, the business vision, the very way we think about what we're doing, our purpose, our legacy? What's the change in all of that that goes with that shift from reducing harm, which is a good thing? I'm not saying it's not a good thing, but it's not good enough. Mm. We actually need to shift to nurturing, and that presents us with a paradigm shift.
Yeah. And you said to remind you to link this back to climate change. So where would you take that next with the work that you can do at a leadership and business level?
So I understand climate change to be a part of the sustainability question. They're not divisible things for me. Climate change is more than just reducing carbon emissions. And let me give you an example to explain why I say that. So I might be fortunate enough to be able to afford a Tesla to reduce my carbon emissions in the immediate sense of not using petrol or gasoline and emitting carbon emissions from the exhaust fumes. But if I'm from a socially disadvantaged part of society, I can't even afford to do that. So you can see that even that has a social justice issue attached to it. And so, you know, carbon emissions are more than just the technology of reducing the carbon. Climate change is more than, or addressing climate change is more than just trying to reduce emissions. It actually includes rethinking the way we do things and rethinking the way we work and live, and right down to the very assumptions that we're making. Like, do we really have to work 40 hours a week? Really? You know, some tribes years and thousands of years ago, if you look at Aboriginal Australia, they worked maybe 3 hours a day to live.
Yeah.
You know, why aren't we asking those sorts of questions?
Yeah, because that goes all the way back to the Industrial Revolution, doesn't it? When people were coming off the land into towns and cities where factories and the real use of time properly kicked in, when you had to be at work and everything was all about production. And we have moved so far away from that. And I think recently with the pandemic, that's become quite, it's almost like put the brakes on that situation, where there aren't planes flying all over the world all the time and there aren't loads of trucks going up and down the motorway so much. And we'd think, oh, well, we don't have to make that business trip. You know, we could do this online. And this, I think there are quite a lot of lessons that we can learn from it if we're going to take the good things out of what's happened rather than just concentrate on all the negative aspects of it.
I think what I'm hearing is, like, we need to change our or test the assumptions with which we're operating on, because we seem to be trying to solve this problem based on a set of assumptions that are no longer relevant for the way that we need to be living and working if we want to nurture, not reduce damage.
I think so. And, you know, questioning what does success look like now, and how do we really want to live our lives? And my experience of the lockdown that we had here in Australia, and I know your third one now, I think, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Which is devastating for many, many people. But it is an ideal time for us to stop and actually pause and rethink, and a lot of people are doing that. So I'm really interested to see what emerges. Certainly within some of the businesses that I work with here, I have heard of a large number of younger employees in particular have actually gone, you know, this is not what I planned or wanted. I'm not doing this anymore. And they're changing jobs. There's quite a bit of churn at the moment within particularly those business. I'm thinking of a gaming company that I did a little bit of work with. Mm-hmm. I don't mean casino, I mean online mobile games. and younger kind of organisations. I'm thinking of another events company that I know of where they employ a large number of young, energetic people, and they're going, you know, I don't like the pressure of this anymore. I actually don't want to work like this anymore. And they, we had the marvellous fortune here in Australia of our politicians deciding to put in some economic policy to help people through the immediate lockdown that we went into way back in March, nearly a year ago now. And we had special payments for people that had jobs but couldn't work. And they had a level of income for months. It's only just being phased out finally now, for months, that kept them afloat. And, you know, social, these sorts of policies, quite socialist in orientation, actually, from a very conservative government, and for the greater good, recognising that actually economic good was dependent upon the health of society, just as you were talking about earlier, Rachel, that it was actually the health of society that mattered more than economics for a moment, and you can't have your economic growth until you've got the health in place. So, you know, these are quite radical times where people are experiencing new things and they're going, oh, this is interesting. I didn't know we could do that. And going, oh, I think I have some more of that. And I'm wondering what change will actually emerge out of all of this. I think it's an exciting time.
It's funny you say that, because there's a lot to criticise about how our government have responded to the pandemic. But at the same time, if you were to look at it through a lens where you didn't know what party, if you didn't have those assumptions about what a party stands for, you would think the economic policies were from the left and social, they were on the Labour side, and it is an incredibly conservative government. And whilst I don't think they're doing amazing in terms of how they've approached it, what I am excited about is where it's going to push Labour in the future, because they have, the Conservative government, the far right, have actually taken the left's ground. And I think, like what you say, what emerges from this as a result, and I think you've got to take your hat off to the current government for actually having a quite socialist economic policy.
And they were kind of forced into it, weren't they? Turns out it made good sense. Yeah. So where will that thinking take us into the future? And I'm really interested in that.
Yeah. Talk us through this concept of bringing the ecology, the climate, the discussion around systems theory into a coaching session with a leadership team.
So first of all, I'd never lay claim to actually having come up with that concept.
I'm going to give it to you.
Thank you very much, Rachel.
I think it's a very coaching thing to say, though, that it's something that's emerged, though, isn't it? I've definitely heard a lot more of it. I don't think anybody could take credit for it, because I think the nature of coaches is we're very curious and everybody's playing around with these concepts. Yeah. And I think I've been very excited about seeing it emerge. What I'm loving is that yourself, even Alison, have kind of run with it. So talk us through how that's evolved for you and what you're seeing and experiencing.
So I guess for me personally, my work in climate goes back to my PhD, and why, you know, I was involved in National Climate Change Adaptation Research Fund research here, and God, what a mouthful, here in Australia. And I got involved in some transdisciplinary research. So that was my first piece of contact with climate change. But I was already interested in sustainability, and they're interchangeable for me. And so as I researched sustainability, I came to see that you could really only understand being sustainable, or sustaining, as I prefer it, because it's a verb, it's a doing, it's a nurturing, sustaining. What's sustaining us? It's moving, as you know, it's more than an object. And I think that distinction is really important. You come to understand those concepts through actually appreciating the interdependence between everything. And that takes you into the world of systems and complexity, or living systems. So I became very interested in living systems in about 2006, and I used it as the lens of my research. And I live in a very conservative country that has been polarised by the climate change discussion for over 10 years. Like, we've been absolutely moribund from it. We've had a carbon trading emission scheme that actually got reversed by the next government. It's gone, you know, it's just a political nightmare. And I think the conversation has really polarised people. So I tried talking about it for a while and discovered that it wasn't a useful portal for actually getting people to do things differently. But what I did discover was that people in organisations are always very interested in science. So I talked about the science of living systems and the applicability and the usefulness of now using a systems approach, not only in terms of their IT systems and processes within business, but also as a way of thinking about how they interrelate with their people, because we're actually living systems. That's what we are. We're actually not robots. Who knew? And so I started talking about the social applications of living systems, and we also used complexity to understand how that we might rethink the way we approach strategy and things like that in businesses too. So without ever even talking about sustainability, I've been sharing these principles in the leadership development work that I do. It's the way I think now. It's the way I be. people get it whether they ask for it or not. So that's been my approach. But other coaches have taken different approaches, and some actually raise it quite directly. And I think over time it's becoming, because society's moving too, it's not standing still. So over time it's becoming more and more acceptable. And I often say to my clients as we're introducing ourselves, I say things like, I'm really passionate about sustainability and climate change. And then I use one of Neil Scotton's lovely little questions, and I say, is that something you care about too? And I just leave it and wait. And they either say yes or no. And that's all right. I'm not there to hit them over the head with it, but I am there to bring it into the conversation. Now, don't think for me that it's actually about bringing the ecology or climate change into the conversation in a sense, because the ecology is already there. And that's a phrase that Professor Peter Hawkins uses a lot. But my understanding of this is, like, you're breathing at the moment, yes? Just check that.
Yeah.
Yep. So you're already in the ecology, right? I've got a glass of water beside me. I'm breathing. And you know, we've got inputs going in and outputs going out. So we're a part of it. You know, it's happening all of the time. And so it's actually more about raising awareness, because people forget they're sitting in an ecology all the time. So it's, for me, it goes back to Sir John Whitmore's basic understanding of what coaching is, that it is actually about just raising awareness and a responsibility to do things differently.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think this is the gorgeous thing that coaches have to bring to the argument, or to the conversation rather than an argument. That was a poor choice of words, I'm sorry. But we have this ability to dance with people. And we don't, you know, we're not there to hit them over the head and tell them what to think, not at all. But if you saw someone, and this goes to my friend Neil Scotton as well, I'm using one of his metaphors here. If you saw someone, one of your clients, standing in the road and a bus was just about to hit them, would you get them out of the way?
Yeah, of course.
Sure. Mm.
Climate change is no different. Mm. Like, it's happening. I know that because 2 weeks ago I evacuated my house due to another fire in the hills here. That fire stopped 1 kilometre from my house. And those fires are of a different nature than they used to be. You talk to the people who fought them, and they will tell you that they're much hotter and they're moving much quicker. And we really dodged a bullet 2 weeks ago. We didn't have any wind and we were very lucky. But, you know, we are at the cusp of a very tumultuous time in our lives as climate change and the impacts become stronger and stronger. And it is happening. And if those businesses that you know now that are in denial around it don't actually wake up, they're going to lose their markets because the world is changing. You can already feel it through coronavirus, can't you? There were winners and losers in coronavirus. There's going to be winners and losers as the weather patterns become more and more extreme too. So I don't think that it's about me bringing my agenda. I think it's me looking after my client and being at service to them, because I don't want that bus to run them over.
It is a paradigm shift. You know, the next decade will see the maturing of all of Gen Z. So anybody that's aged 10 to 24 now is classed as Generation Z or Z, whichever part of the world you live in and how you label it.
Yep.
And it's nearly 2 billion people. It's like that cohort of people is 1.8 billion people. And I think what is fascinating about this next decade is in 10 years' time, that will be 26% of our population that are consumers. Like, let's think about it in business terms. And Gen Z will be the most powerful generation by far, because it's the biggest generation by far, because predominantly it's Asia that fall into this cohort. And that's going to shift the makeup of our society in its entirety, because this generation are very unique in that they have grown up experiencing firsthand the impacts and effects of climate change. And they have seen it on their newsfeed. They've had direct access to it. And they have physically had an opinion on it and had their lifestyle affected by it. And I think that's very different for millennials. It's very different for baby boomers. It's very different for other generations, because we can remember and have nostalgia about a better time, and that prevents us from sometimes acting. Gen Z don't have that. And I think, you know, when we talk about the bus and the client standing in the road, I think to bring it to a bigger analogy, it's your customer base of the next decade are telling you and showing you that they don't know a world where this isn't a reality for them.
Mm. I think that's entirely right. Like, the social license for some businesses will disappear. I'm convinced of that.
I totally 100%.
You know, if you're making plastic popcorn makers in a variety of colours, I don't think the market will go on tolerating that.
No, because like you say, there will be winners and losers, and a very difficult challenge in a few years' time, where what happens when you've got climate change refugees? It's already happening. Yeah. I interrupted John. You had a question on Josie's last.
You've raised a whole load of thoughts in my mind there. Just to cover off what you were saying there, Rachel. So for that generation, it isn't a paradigm shift like it is for our generation.
It may still be, if I can interrupt your thinking and you're speaking for a moment, because our thinking is actually deeply socialized. It's deeply cultural. And so they may, you know, younger people, and certainly, you know, the kids I see here in Australia, the education system's done a brilliant job at raising their awareness. And we still have the cultural constructs that inform us, yes, of the old paradigm.
Yeah. But of course, because you could say that about prejudice, couldn't you? And what if, you know, people behave how they were brought up in many respects. So, yes, I guess it which makes it even more important then that we move towards a strong sustainability rather than this weak sustainability, and we have to add back. And I was just thinking, right at the very beginning, Josie, you said that you've always been very future orientated. And I think that's the whole gamut of coaching for me, is that it's about moving people forward. So if you've got CEOs particularly precious about making sure that his people are looked after, that he, you know, that he's compassionate and that they have the right values and in terms of how his team work together and the relationships between them, then all we're asking them to do is to extend that awareness to the planet and everything that's going on it in and it as it's part of that ecosystem that you talked about. So it is, I absolutely agree with you. I think it is about raising people's awareness. It's not that it's not there. It's just that in the context of the way that people just go to work and come home on a night, it doesn't necessarily come to mind. But it comes to mind when your house is about to be burnt down. And I think for you guys over there, you know, your extremes in weather, just weather, are way more extreme than ours are, that they are here in the UK. And so you get firsthand graphic representation of what's going on, but it is about extending it, isn't it, to a wider context, I think.
I think so. And there's something that happens within organisational life. Like, we kind of compartmentalise ourselves when we go to work. We leave a bit of ourselves at home somehow. And, you know, in my work, I've had conversations with people who say to me, I say to them, you know, we really want your full self at work. We want to understand what's important to you, and we want to make a pathway available for you to express those values. And they're shocked. They are in disbelief, and they go, no one wants to know what I really think. And they don't really want to know what I care about.
Oh, Josie,
they look at me like I'm crazy. So we have created this thing with it. We've created this construct within organisations that really has people expecting to leave a bit of them at home. And these are more traditional organisations. And I'm so excited to see some of the younger businesses emerge where they really are embracing people as a whole. And I think that's what the future will be, because my belief is that in our hearts, all of we humans actually know the environment we need to sustain us. And if we go down to that level and ask people what they really want, how they really want to live their life, I've never had anyone actually answer that question with a comment about money or a Lamborghini or anything. They talk about, I want connection, I want love, I want community, family, I want to have autonomy, some mastery in the work that I do, the opportunity to be creative, a little bit of nature around me, I enjoy the greenery. These are the sorts of things that they talk about, and I suspect that these are the values of sustainability, which kind of makes sense that we would know what we need, because that's the way we've evolved. Yeah. But it's a different type of knowing than the intellectual knowing, you know?
I wonder on that. I get very interested in what has gone wrong with the branding of climate change, because like you said, John, if there's not one person that isn't aware that it's happening, whether or not they believe it and where they sit on the stories they tell themselves are quite different. So I lived in Australia and it was so polarizing. You're either for it or against it. And it is this notion of, I guess, cognitive dissonance around it, where you say, but what I do doesn't matter. I get that I want this to happen, but actually if I drive a Range Rover or a gas guzzling 4x4, I'm just one person, it doesn't matter. But what I'm liking around this notion of sustainability and nurturing is it takes it to a different place where it's not as polarizing. And I think I don't know whether it's economics or science or where this argument of the proof for climate change or if we can influence it has come from. But when you think about it in terms of sustainability or nurturing and the lives we want to live, it becomes a much more agreeable conversation. Does that make sense? I'm just trying to kind of, I guess, make sense of it to myself, of where we can go with this with leaders of the next generation.
You know, my experience is that when you ask people what they really want, how they really want to experience life and work, they're in total agreement. We're just arguing about the how.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that thing is so true though, isn't it? But I think that thing about why is it that there's still some people will make some decisions in work that they would never make out of work?
Yeah, so there's that compartmentalization again. Like we've learned different rules to use in there than we use out here in our lives. Like I come from a background of strategic planning, and I'm completely, I laugh every time I think of myself doing that now, because I used to write 15-year plans. Like I'm so old that 15-year-old plans seem a reasonable thing to do. Like I don't even write three-month plans for my business now. I don't know about you. Just thinking 1 week ahead is enough. And yet, you know, we don't live our lives making plans like that, most of us.
No.
Most of us have some sort of intention or vision.
Yeah.
And then we just try things out. You know, do you get married with a plan with milestones and learning outcomes and everything attached to it?
And you a financial value given to you.
Did you go to a budget to go along with it for 20 years? Yeah.
And we'll be worth this much collectively by the time we're this age. You don't, do you? You know, you're right. But you do think about the environment that you want to create, you know, a loving, nurturing home, a safe place, something that looks nice, and how you want to feel in that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely
so living systems actually have an attractiveness to them. Like when they're alive and they're blossoming, they're healthy is a better word, they are actually attractive and they are alluring. So, you know, if something isn't sort of alluring to you, it may not be particularly healthy.
Mm.
There's a challenging thought.
Yeah, and I like this idea, though, around how organisations and leaders could take this into a, you know, we talk about productive cultures, we talk about, you know, great people-focused cultures, but actually a nurturing, a self-sustaining and nurturing culture has an alluring effect of it. You know, it should rejuvenate itself, it should grow more organically. And I think when you take it to that level, people can really see the benefit of it.
And this is what we've done within the Climate Coaching Alliance, or tried to, Eve, Alison and I. We've been very mindful of the principles that we have used to nurture the network. And it's not an organisation. We wouldn't talk about it in that term. We don't have a bank account, because if we had a bank account, and this is my influence more than Eve and Alison, so I'm talking for myself now. This is my belief. If we have a bank account, then we are compelled to have a constitution, to have a board, to have audits. All of that, you start tapping back into the old paradigm again. And yet we've got this really mobile, active, engaged membership that's grown from three people a bit over a year ago to nearly 800 today. It's just grown really rapidly, and it's currently crowdsourcing a conference like crazy. Like there's so much energy flowing in it, people doing exactly what their hearts are drawing them to do, exactly what their strengths have designed them to do. And I think work can be like that too. I've seen that happen within my own engagements within organisations. We can nurture this environment. And I've seen productivity within organisations double.
Yeah. Do you want to give some examples of ways that this has been done in organisations? And then we'll talk about the network and the event you've got coming up for climate coaching.
I think it's really simple, you know, that there are day-to-day changes in management. And if you think about the way organisations are classically, traditionally developed and the management style that is encouraged, when we use the word management or manager, what does it usually infer? It's someone who's controlling, scheduling and arranging and organising. Control, I think, is the crucial word here. And if we make this paradigm shift and actually see the world as an interdependent living system, and we start to use that metaphor for how we think about our organisations, then we might think about how much we can give up control. And don't get me wrong, there are some personal levels of control we need for our own safety. But we don't have to control everything. We don't have to be control freaks over everything. You know, we can actually use the resources that are within people and encourage them. So if we use people's strengths, if we use their passions, there is research that shows that people are more creative, that they will persist at problems for longer. They will endure for longer because they are passionate about something. So you can devise solutions to really difficult, challenging problems that you wouldn't do otherwise if you just had people remaining in their little box of skills and experience rather than engaging the whole person and letting it loose. How can we liberate people within organisations? And that's where I focus my attention with people who are managing people in organisations. Can we shift from control to liberation? And what does that mean for my leadership? That's the question to ask. What does it mean I do? If I'm not the giver of answers, what do I do? Your role is actually to facilitate the liberation of people, to facilitate the learning within the organisation.
I think you've raised a really interesting point there, Josie, because I'm just thinking back to my early days in corporate life where people would come to work and there'd be one person at work and there would be a very different person out of work. And I think that's changed quite a lot now where people are feeling like they can give more of themselves and be more just them, just more the individual character that they are, and they don't have to separate the two. I think what really is interesting is that if we're going to do the things that we want to do and the things that we've talked about on this podcast, you have to have people giving themselves, and they can't be two different characters, because all of that, the whole idea behind being two different people was about control. It was about this is how I have to behave in order that I can control the controllables. And people were not vulnerable, and we all know that you know that vulnerability is a great leadership quality. So I definitely think that has got to be the starting point. And it's like a lot of the work that Rachel and I do around culture and values and behavior and mission, vision, all that sort of stuff, purpose. That's where we get people to, because without that, you can't move on.
Yeah, but again, it's a shift for the follower as well as the leader, isn't it? There's nothing stranger than working for somebody that is being coached, because they experiment with a lot of things, their behavior becomes less predictable, they grow, they start to push you, and they ask you to start thinking for yourself. And having been somebody who's worked for somebody who's been coaching, it can be a very strange place to be. and the whole system has to, and I think this is the thing, right? You can't coach somebody in a system or a leader and not expect that it to have ripple effects throughout the wider system. And we need to give everybody chance to kind of recalibrate and absorb the new energy.
Yeah. You know, they've learned not to care because they've been hit over the head so many times. You know, so it's Martin Seligman's idea of learned helplessness. You know? Yes. And they've got to be persuaded that it's okay to care again.
Yeah.
What would be your tips for a leader listening to this, if they're curious in this space and they're thinking they're in an organisation that thinks quite traditionally, but they'd like to be part of this movement, what would be your tips and questions and things that they can be doing and asking?
So first of all, I think starting by reflecting inwards, what's important to you? What is actually important to you? Because it's those values that actually fuel our leadership. Exercising leadership can be a tricky business because when you're actually out to change the status quo, if you're in a traditional organisation and you're non-traditional, so if you actually see the need to change the status quo, you know, you're putting yourself up against a lot of values that have stood the test of time, a lot of beliefs and values that are meshed into the organisational culture. So have a look inside, find out what you care about, pick your fights carefully, choose the ones that you're going to take on and let go the ones that really aren't worth it. And secondly, I'd say find some friends. Don't go alone. It's like kindergarten when they taught us to always hold hands when you're crossing the road.
Yeah.
It's better to work in groups because you're less vulnerable in a group if you're trying to change the status quo. And then thirdly, I think I'd say don't ever underestimate the power. This is Margaret Mead's quote, of a small group of people. So in my research, we used a small group of people to seed an entire organisational transformation. It was just five people and they were not from the top of the organisation. They were people who were passionate.
Yeah.
And it emerged over a period of time. It doesn't have to be planned. So don't underestimate the power of a small group of people, and don't underestimate the power of talking about what you really want, because that actually fuels the decisions that you'll make and the conversations that you'll have as you're out and about every day in your organisation doing what you do and what you have to do. You will ask different questions as a result of the conversations you've had with that small group of people who are like-minded. So that are the ones that come immediately to mind.
That's brilliant. And I love that thing about passion, because it will trump profit every time, won't it? People will follow the passion. And when you couple that with persistence, it's incredible what it can achieve. So I really
and that
like
small
that.
Group will nurture you as yeah. well. Yeah.
Yeah, that's super useful. So let's talk about your passion right now, the Climate Coaching Alliance, your passion. I am a new member. I'm super excited to be part of this group. So, you know, you talked about how you don't have a bank account and it's only a year yeah. old. But just for our listeners, any coaches that are listening, and of course, any leaders that are looking for coaches, it's always good to have a coach that's thinking yeah. along lines as well. But talk us through what it is and what you're about and what's coming up.
So what is it? Yeah. It's a group of coaches who are interested in learning how to engage with this large social issue that we call climate change within our coaching conversations in a way that honours our client, as we do as coaches, and helps to progress action that we need so desperately in our world to actually start moving and making a real difference to the trajectory of climate change in the world. So that's what we're on about. We are doing that in a couple of different ways, through attracting coaches, and we are growing really rapidly at the moment, at a pace that is probably really testing Eve Allison and my energy levels and ability to sustain it. And we are attracting as many people as we can into the core of the organisation now to bolster our energy so that we've got enough energy to keep up with everyone else. Mm-hmm. And people are really coming together. It's like an active learning lab. That's what we're trying to do. Like, if there was an answer to how to do this, we would have already done it, right? So yeah. we're coming with the assumption that we don't know. Lots of people have different ideas. Like, I've got my set of ideas, but other people have other ideas. And it's not that one idea is better than another. They just suit us because we're different people. So we're interested in learning different ways and engaging with each other so that we can learn from each other and try things out. Secondly, we're also very interested in trying to work systemically within the profession as well. So Eve has been successful in her role of chair of APEX as well, in engaging other professional bodies. And I think we're up to about 11 now, professional bodies globally who have signed a joint statement to actually make a difference on climate change. And we are very interested now in this year to talk with the coach training bodies about what does the curriculum actually need if we are to have a cohort, you know, a whole heap of coaches who are well equipped to have these conversations with their clients, because that's what our clients are going to be needing. So we're trying to do several things at the one time, and we are, I suppose, hopeful that in a few years' time we won't even be needed anymore. Wouldn't that be brilliant if the industry had transformed itself and gone, yeah, we've got this, we're doing it, and the need for us would disappear, and that would be brilliant too. So at the moment, we're engaged in organising our third Around the World 24-hour conversation. So the first two we held actually started in New Zealand, and every hour on the hour, they moved around the time zones around the world, and we had the same conversation 24 times. It was never the same conversation, of course, because there were always different people. And we had different local hosts as we went around the world too. This third one, we thought about doing it the same way again. And then, I don't know, we had this idea of perhaps crowdsourcing a conference instead. And so we asked our members, what would you like to do? And they started coming up with all of these ideas for different types of conversations and different workshops that they want to put on to share what they've learned. And so we've been on a journey of what is climate change? How is it relevant to coaches? Do we need permission? Like, aren't we meant to follow the client's agenda? Does this mean we're going against that? And we've looked at the ethics with the second conversation and gone, actually, we just need permission from ourselves, because coaching ethics actually allows us to say, I care about climate change, do you? That's okay, you know. What is it that you care about? What's in the future that you might need to be thinking of in order to be most effective in what you're doing? So this third conversation is about actually sharing what we've been learning and really getting into action around it. And it's a whole wide range of conversations. We're really excited about it.
Yeah, amazing. So for anybody that's listening that's a coach or a leader that's very interested in coaching as well.
Oh, we would love to see them come along.
Yeah. When is this event and how can people get involved?
Okay, it's on the 4th of March, 2021, just in case you think of this in the future. you can find us at climatecoachingalliance.org, and then just have a look at the events tab and you'll find the third global conversation under the events tab and a program for it. So there's 24 hours in the day, and we've got up to 5 sessions running concurrently. There's so much energy that we're well over 52 presentations now. And they're not just presentations, they're really active workshops. Like, for example, one is walking around in the countryside and actually understanding how we might coach in nature and use nature in our coaching. So they're really pragmatic types of things. And you can come along, you just have to register. They're free and it's open to everyone.
Yeah, what I really love about this approach is everything is super transparent. It's free. It's 24 hours. So wherever you are in the world, there is something for everybody. It's equally accessible in that there's 5 sessions every hour. And you can just dip in and dip out. You know, I've blocked out the day, but I, being realistic, I can probably only intake the information from about 6. So you've kind of got to go, what am I going to go for and what's going to nourish me? But I think you've done a really good job of getting a program like that. And I think if anybody's just interested in this field and doesn't know what to expect, I'd really encourage you to just come along, because just the curiosity of being introduced to something new will be the start of that paradigm shift.
And we use Professor Hawkins' eco cycle in devising the program as well, So it moves through five different stages. So it starts off with curious. So if you're just new to understanding coaching and leadership, bringing these concepts in, look for the ones that color-coded for eco-curious. If you've been in the space a long time, look for the ones that are color-coded eco-active, and you'll find that wheel on the program as well. So it gives you a bit of an entry point depending upon where you're at.
That's absolutely brilliant. So you've actually modeled the whole conference dependent on where people are at. So you're kind of meeting the audience, leaders and coaches, at where they're at, not what you're wanting to get across.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I love it so much.
That's what we do. We meet people where they are, right?
Well that's exactly right. And I think if everybody takes that point, the journey is, I mean, it can be as complicated, as complex, as chaotic, or as simple as you like, but actually we're all as a species on the same journey. It's just where on that line you sit.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. John, any questions before we close out?
Love it. I really love it. I think that's a really useful event for people to springboard into where they want to take this. I can imagine so many conversations, so many different conversations. I'm definitely going to be logging in. That's good, really good.
And I must say, I may be a bit biased, but by and large, the membership in our network is a really set of experienced, very knowledgeable and thoughtful, and very heartfelt people. So when you turn up to one of the events that they put on, you can be assured that it's high quality. You know, it's very amazing. It's an amazing group of people. I'm astounded by them.
So before we close out, it would be amiss of us to not ask for you for your words of wisdom on what your three leadership essentials are around the space of climate change and leadership. So if you would, I think that'd be a lovely way to end, if you could share those, please.
Oh, thank you, Rachel. I want to thank you and John for having me too. It's been a delight talking with you. So if I do this reasonably quickly, I think. So I think the first thing would be to those people that are perhaps a little bit older, you know, just to recognise that climate change is not an add-on. It's here, it's now, and we need to attend to it. There'll be so many interruptions to business going forward. And if we don't take notice of it, we're going to pay the price. So, you know, it's not an add-on. It's actually just part of the business environment that we're in. Secondly, I'd say really embrace the uncertainty. There is a lot of uncertainty and there will be more uncertainty going forward, I think. And I think you can use legacy and purpose as your guide through that uncertainty. So that's a great way of navigating your way and not getting lost. And we talked a little bit about how we think, you know, there will be winners and losers as we move forward. But cling to that purpose and legacy, your vision for what you're trying to do. And thirdly, I think one of the things we're going to see within organisations and leadership in particular is developing this ability to be adaptable, not just to adapt once, but to adapt over and over. How adaptable can we be? And we will see the emergence of an interest in cultures within organisations and teams that are truly adaptable, that they're developing that capability on a really deliberate level. So I think there are three things to keep in mind.
Yeah, really, really powerful. That last one in particular, because I think a lot of the criticism that comes at leaders is you said you were going to do this, or this was your point of view a couple of years ago, and then the press always pull them back up on it or challenge them. And I think if you could really own that adaptability, and I got new information and I have changed in response to that information, I think if people were more confident in having that conversation and role modeling that more, that is Darwin's theory, right? That's how we're all going to survive. To bring it back
the ability to learn. Yep.
Well, thank you very much for your time. We're going to let you, go off and have a nice, lovely glass of wine now in the Adelaide Hill. The Penfold Estates there, John. If ever we get over to Australia, I'll have to take you there. It's absolutely fabulous.
It's just up the road.
Absolutely fine. You're making me miss it tremendously. I've got some wonderful memories of Adelaide. But it's been absolutely lovely to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to the event on the 4th of March and looking forward to seeing you then.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, John.
Josie, thank you for your time. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.